now plugged in to the Delphi podcast.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to the Delphi podcast. I'm Tom Shaughnessy, and I help lead Delphi Ventures, as well as host some of the most in-the-weeds and thought-provoking guests across crypto, spanning layer ones to DeFi, NFTs, and beyond. The goal is to have fun, but also to dive deep and offer foundational episodes on projects and founders. Also, check out our research on Delphi Digital or miss out on the most compelling research there is. It's up to you. As a reminder, nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token or to make any financial decisions. Delphi Ventures may hold tokens mentioned, so check out our transparency page in the show notes for more info. With that, let's dive in. See you guys on the other side. Before we jump in, we'd like to thank our sponsors for making this episode possible. Kava is a cross-chain DeFi platform that gives you the ability to earn more by connecting the world's largest cryptocurrencies, ecosystems, and financial applications in one safe and seamless integration. We're excited for the upcoming launch of the Swap Protocol, a cross-chain AMM liquidity hub bridging DeFi, blockchains, and financial services to swap the world's largest assets and maximize yields across your entire portfolio. Swap will join the Kava Protocol and Hart Protocol as the next application built on the Kava platform. Celo is a mobile-first platform that makes financial dApps and crypto payments accessible to anyone with a mobile phone, providing the opportunity to positively impact the users of 6 billion smartphones in circulation today. Celo's eco-friendly proof-of-stake consensus mechanism and ultra-mobile light client makes up to 17,000 times faster than other blockchains and accessible to mobile phone users around the world. Visit Celo.org to learn more.
Hello, everyone. This is Ken from Delphi Research. Together with me today, I have Chris from Hop Protocol. Hop is a generic token bridge across different scaling solutions revolving around Ethereum. And it's a very exciting project, and I can't get to dive into it. But it's a pleasure to have you here with me today, Chris. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on today, Ken.
So before we dive in, actually, I know Hop is not the first project you've been working on, and you've been in the space since many years now. So can you talk a little bit about what you've been doing, what it made you to arrive to Hop Protocol today?
Sure. I think I first got introduced to crypto around 2014, but it wasn't until kind of late 2016, 2017 that I started to work full time. So I was living in Boston doing iOS development, and you know, there wasn't a lot of opportunities to work in crypto. And so I was working for an agency, and I ended up quitting the agency, and I started the Boston Ethereum Developer Meetup to kind of meet other people that were into Ethereum at the time. And then with a few friends, started a dev shop called Level K. And we were building smart contracts for people that were looking for that as a service, and using that to kind of bootstrap ourselves and start building projects. And so, with Level K, we ended up starting an auditing practice, and that was, you know, something that I led up within the company. And we worked with a lot of great projects, like we audited the Open Zeppelin framework, DYDX, Trust Token, Decentraland, and a handful of others. And so that was kind of my first, you know, full-time job within the crypto space. And so I met my current co-founders, Shane and Miguel, when I moved out to Los Angeles maybe three and a half years ago. And so, you know, we were all working together at Level K, and then we ended up spinning the auditing business out to go after this new opportunity that we're really excited about. And that opportunity was contract-based accounts. And so we launched Authereum, which is a contract-based account wallet built for casual users. And so the idea behind Authereum was you could just kind of sign up with a username and password, and just made the onboarding process and getting in, you know, starting to use Ethereum applications really easy for first-time users. And then pretty quickly, DeFi took off, and you know, so did the gas market along with it. And when it cost us maybe 15 cents to deploy this contract-based account for new users when we started, We quickly push that cost over to the user, and at one point it would cost over $250 just to deploy to deploy this contract based account. I think it would cost even more than that some days today. So we really saw layer two as kind of the only future for Ethereum and for casual users in general. Like Ethereum itself was just too expensive. The cost to deploy an Ethereum account was roughly two Uniswap swaps. So even if you could get the account deployed, there wasn't much you could do unless you were dealing with large amounts of money and you could kind of justify that cost. So we kind of had our backs against the wall, and we're looking for ways that we could allow users to move directly from one layer to the next, so that they didn't have to kind of come back to layer one. So with Ethereum, we started integrating with layer two solutions, such as like Diversify and Loopring, and we saw that users would kind of bridge over to the solution. They'd make a few transactions and then they bridge back. But the cost just to kind of get onto and off of layer two was more than they were saving if they just used the layer one applications, directly. And so we knew that users kind of had to be layer two native, and that they had to be able to, get onto layer two and then stay on layer two. So we came up with Hop Protocol. We put out a paper about it earlier this year. And just to get some feedback and along with a demo for how it could work. And the response was really overwhelmingly positive. So we decided to kind of focus on this completely and realize that, this could be, true Ethereum core infrastructure and could be, a bigger opportunity than what we were looking at with Ethereum. So that's kind of how we got started on Hop and to where we are today.
Yeah, I appreciate that information. So the future of Ethereum is, as stated by Vitalik, is a roll-up centric one. I mean, he laid out this vision years back, and only now we're seeing a glimpse of it with the start of launch of Optimism, Arbitrum. There are also ZK roll-ups like Starkware and ZK Sync. So, but I noticed that many people are still not very familiar with how rollups work in general. And given that you're very accustomed to them, could you maybe explain how is a rollup working in general sense, and what is it that makes them so special?
Sure. So yeah, with Ethereum scaling, we've always heard that scaling is right around the corner for like years and years and years now. And it feels like rollups are kind of the first one that really addresses everything that we've dreamed of with layer two, where it feels like layer one, we can deploy applications, we can deploy smart contracts. And so a rollup is kind of this partial scaling solution. And so what I mean is that it scales in terms of execution. But it still uses, a scaling solution has execution and then data availability. And so those are the two pieces that kind of are the two main costs of using Ethereum. And so any scaling solution needs to scale, both of those, or, in the case of a rollup, it's a partial scaling solution because it just scales execution and not data availability. But this trade-off allows us to basically use layer one Ethereum to, as this data availability layer and allows us to kind of order all of our transactions. So what I mean by that is each rollup has what's known as a state root, and Ethereum itself has a state root. And this basically represents all of the state on the solution or on Ethereum. Mm-hmm. And so a rollup state root is rooted into a smart contract on Ethereum. And when, as kind of the rollup progresses, we basically say, here are all the transactions. These are kind of updates to state, and we'll get from the current state root to some new state root, and then have some validation around, whether or not these updates or these transactions that went from, state root A to state root B are kind of, it is a valid transition. And so that's where, the way that those updates are validated, that's kind of where the difference between an optimistic rollup and a ZK rollup, start to diverge. And so, when users are making transactions, they basically submit them to the rollup, and then those will actually get posted on chain. So all of the transactions that you're making on, say, Optimism or Arbitrum, they're actually going and being posted on layer one Ethereum. And that's why you'll see that rollups have this kind of non-negligible cost, like you might see with these non-rollup scaling solutions like Polygon and XDAI. Mm-hmm. And so once these transactions get posted onto Ethereum, they're not executed. You know, it's just posted for data availability. But it does kind of lock in the order. So if anyone's kind of looking at these transactions, they can say like, okay, here's the last update that we have on Ethereum. And then here is the data of all these transactions. But you know, no one's actually run the execution of these transactions on chain. But if I'm an off-chain participant, I can look at the ordering of these transactions and I can look at the state route that we had last, and I can actually figure out the current state of the chain by just executing them myself off-chain. And that's kind of where you get the scalability, where you know, the execution has been pushed off-chain for the most part. And so then, you know, the kind of harder part is getting to that next update. And so with an optimistic rollup, someone will just post the update, and then it's actually a week before that's finalized. And that week-long period basically gives people enough time to challenge these transactions that were posted between this state route and this state route actually led, you know, were all valid state transitions. And if there's a challenge, the challenge can play out, and then the state can be updated within that week. And then a ZK rollup uses some really cool, you know, cryptography to basically prove that all of these transactions that were posted led from the state route A to state route B. And then it could just be proved on the spot. It's final on the spot. And there's no challenge game. There's no, week-long wait period. And that's why you'll see the exit times on ZK rollups are way faster than they are on optimistic rollups.
Thank you for that. Really good intro. So with that, actually, you touched on the point between the ZK and optimistic rollups, and especially with regards to the optimistic rollups, I also find that a lot of people misconfuse the 7-day challenge period, 7-day withdrawal period, actually. So just want to clarify that when Optimism writes the posts, Optimism is called the sequencer. There's an entity that posts transactions to layer one. But when they post that in order, actually, and a full verifier node would actually be able to, as soon as it's minted on layer one, a full verifier L2 node would execute them, and he would know 100% the state of the optimistic rollup, so there would be no risk for them. So the 7-day withdrawal period is for users who not necessarily have the resources to compute these themselves. So I think that's the fundamental piece that most people miss, and it's also a crucial part of how Hop protocol functions, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we think of it as kind of on-chain finality and off-chain finality. If you're an off-chain participant, you can pretty easily compute, you know, all these state updates and get to finality, you know, pretty much after that batch has been submitted or your transaction has been submitted. And then if you're on-chain, you know, the execution can't play out on-chain, otherwise we wouldn't be scaling. And therefore, you have to kind of wait for this week-long challenge period.
Got it. So with that, let's walk through how Hop protocol comes into play here. So I'm a user on Rollup A, and I want to transfer my tokens to Rollup B, let's say from Optimism to Arbitrum. So what is it that Hop protocol helps me to do, and what guarantees do I get as a user? What security guarantees I have?
Sure. Yeah, so Hop basically allows you to transfer your tokens directly from one rollup to the next, or one scaling solution to the next, and this happens almost immediately. We basically wait for that, you know, the source chain to reach off-chain finality. So that takes about roughly 5 minutes for the most part, and then your transfer is completed. And Hop doesn't introduce any new trust assumptions. You know, there's obviously smart contract risk with any kind of DeFi application that you're using. But it doesn't introduce like a new validator set. It doesn't introduce a new consensus algorithm. It's actually just using and leveraging the scaling solutions themselves, the message bridges between the scaling solutions and Ethereum. And it, you know, does the rest, you know, completely trustlessly. And so, you know, to kind of get an idea of how Hop works, I think it's important to understand how the kind of native bridges for rollups themselves work. And so each rollup will have a cross-domain messenger. And so this basically allows, contracts on the rollup to talk to contracts on layer one Ethereum, and then layer one Ethereum to talk to contracts on the rollup. And so the communication from Ethereum to the rollup, that happens almost immediately. It happens, in the time it takes for layer one to reach finality. So also, 5 to 10 minutes. And then communication from layer two to layer one, that is only as fast as the exit time of the rollup. So if we're talking about an optimistic rollup, then messages from the rollup to layer one Ethereum are going to take that full week before they can be executed. And so, the reason that all rollups have this messaging bridge is because it's needed for the native bridge. And so, the idea with rollups is you don't want to just have this siloed environment where you have tokens on that rollup. You want to actually use the tokens that are on Ethereum on that rollup. And so in order to make this kind of native token bridge for the rollup, the rollups will have this kind of lockbox on layer one Ethereum. Users deposit tokens into it, and then they're minted a representation of that token on layer two. And that native token bridge is all built around their cross-domain messenger, which allows the messages to be shared. And so that's why why the exit time is also weak, because the user actually will decide to exit. They'll burn their token on layer two. That will trigger a message from layer two to Ethereum, and it won't be able to be executed. The exit won't be able to be executed for a full week. So that's kind of the native cross-domain messenger and the native bridge for each rollup. And so what Hop essentially is at the core is this cross rollup messaging protocol. And so the core of the problem is actually the messaging itself, not, and then on top of that, we've built token transfers. And so you could imagine kind of a naive way to, if we're trying to talk, say, from Arbitrum to Optimism, the naive way to send a message would be to, propagate your message down to layer one Ethereum and then back up to the destination. And so that's not very scalable because for each individual message, we're going to need a transaction on layer one Ethereum. And then we're, kind of have this big bottleneck because, we can't kind of scalably send messages between Optimism and Arbitrum. And so what we came up with Hop is we actually aggregate many messages at the source. So we won't actually trigger them to be sent. We'll just kind of like store them in state on the rollup itself. And then at some point we will move the whole batch of aggregated messages from the source to the destination. So we kind of compress this whole batch of transactions into what's known as a Merkle root. And then, so we just have this single hash, and then we can propagate this single hash that could represent thousands of messages down to layer one Ethereum to the destination. And then at the destination, it can be unpacked. And that kind of alleviates this layer one bottleneck for kind of cross rollup communication. And so just like the rollups on top of their cross domain messengers, the first thing they built is their native bridge. On top of our kind of cross scaling solution messaging protocol, the first thing that we built on top of that is cross scaling solution token transfers. And so the way that the token transfers work is we introduce our own, asset. And so this asset we call an H token. And so just like with the native bridge, you deposit into a lockbox and you get some representation of that token on layer two. For the native bridge, we call it the canonical token. Those are the ones that users actually want, USDC, ETH, et cetera. And then for Hop, you deposit and then you get H token, like HUSDC, HE, et cetera.
Right. So just to expand on that point, you mentioned about the message contracts. So correct me if I'm wrong, but any application, I mean, once it's fully deployed on an open mainnet, these rollups are not whitelisted, et cetera. Any application can actually interact with that messenger and then represent and then create a representation of L1 token inside the rollup. So you would, for instance, see a bunch of DAIs there, right? Different versions of DAI. But eventually, there's a native rollup bridge, and that's the one that you're referring to as canonical token. So there will be, for instance, in the case of, let's say, Arbitrum, there we can call it maybe a DAI, an Arbitrum DAI, and that will be the canonical one. But the hub bridge would be a different token, right? Would be like H DAI. So, and you mentioned that eventually users want to get Arbitrum DAI. So, how does this work after that point? So we have a hub version of the token. Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so, you know, users ultimately want this A DAI or you know, canonical DAI. And we introduced this HDAI because we need to kind of program in this special bridging functionality directly into the asset. So when a user kind of transfers an H token from one wallet to the next, the H token is burned at the source. And then, you know, we have this liquidity provider role that mints it at the destination. But ultimately, users don't want HDAI. They don't really care about HDAI. They want real DAI, the ADAI. So we have stable swap AMMs between the H tokens and their you know, true or canonical assets. So that would be, you know, say HDAI to ADAI. And so that way, when the liquidity provider, we call this role the bonder, mints HDAI for the user because they've made a transfer, then it immediately gets swapped through the AMM into the canonical DAI, and then that's the one that the user can go on and, you know, deposit into Aave using Uniswap. That's the one that's going to be kind of widely adopted in that rollups ecosystem.
Right. And also, just to make sure this point doesn't get missed, you also touched on the point that in a rollup, a lot of transactions, you batch them together into a compact size, and then this gets propagated through layer one to another rollup. But the so here, actually, the question then becomes like why there's a need for an intermediate token, and then you're also talking about the bonders minting token. So what is the motivation behind this to have a hop representation of tokens to cross assets, actually? Can we expand on that?
Yeah, so you know, for hop to function as it is functioning, we need to be able to basically burn this token at the source and then mint it at the destination. And so with kind of the canonical tokens, or the, you know, basically the tokens that are the representations produced by the rollups native bridge, we aren't able to kind of program that functionality into them directly.
What do you mean when you say like we cannot program the functionality?
So when with the H tokens, they basically will send a very or when an H token is burned, that's when it kind of adds a message to the list of kind of pending transfers that will kind of eventually get aggregated into the batch that gets transported from the source to the destination. And so we aren't able to kind of, with the native bridge tokens, when they're burned, you basically just get to claim it on layer one. And we want to actually claim it at the destination. So we kind of need this different model that we can't, and we don't have that level of control with the native assets.
Understood. And then let's continue from that point on. A user burns the H token, let's say he mm-hmm. wants to, yeah, and then what's the following chain of events from there on?
So the user burns the H token, and then this role called the bonder, one of the bonders will kind of see this transfer has been initiated, and then they will come in and complete the transfer. And you know, they basically have collateral locked up, and that allows them to mint H token, you know, per you know, the same amount that the user transferred minus a small fee at the destination. And then that immediately gets swapped into the Canonical token. So from the user's perspective, they're just going from, you know, DAI on Optimism to DAI on Arbitrum. They don't really have to think about this intermediary H token at all. It's completely abstracted away from them. Yes. But then they get tokens at the destination.
Got it. So user has, again, the Canonical DAI on Optimism. He basically wants to transfer it to Arbitrum. He creates a hop transaction, and the hop transaction is first converting that to H version, the hop version of DAI on the origin rollup, and then this one gets burned, and then in Arbitrum again, hop version of DAI gets minted. And then it gets converted to the canonical DAI on Arbitrum. Is that correct?
That's exactly correct.
So the bonders here are actually playing a crucial role, right? Because once they see the intention of user, they front liquidity, and in order to do that, they're putting up a collateral during the time it takes for the transaction to settle out on layer one. So in terms of capital efficiency, how do you see a hop protocol? Yeah.
Yeah, so in terms of capital efficiency, so to take a step back, hop basically has two types of liquidity. We kind of have this passive liquidity, and these are people that are providing liquidity to the AMMs. And then we have this, what we call active liquidity, because the bonder needs to kind of run this off-chain process. They're the ones that are kind of fully verifying the source chain, making sure that they're not being defrauded or something like that. And, you know, so it's kind of this active role where their liquidity is you know, they're consistently making transactions with their liquidity. And so you know, ultimately with bridging, there needs to be some reserve of the canonical token that can be accessed by folks that are bridging, because there needs to be, you know, basically some pool that they can kind of tap into and pull tokens from when they arrive at the destination. And so that's how we kind of think of the AMM liquidity. And so that, I think, is optimal. Like there's no way to kind of I don't think there's a way to kind of better use that liquidity, because there ultimately has to be some reserve pool. And then the kind of collateral that the bonder locks up, this is where we see an inefficiency in the current implementation of hop. And so the bonder uses this collateral to kind of front liquidity or you know, mint these H tokens. And right now they're using the same asset that they're bridging. So if it's DAI that they're bridging, they're locking up DAI. You know, if it's ETH that they're bridging, they're locking up ETH. In the future, we're going to kind of decouple the bonders collateral from the asset they're bridging. And so, you know, this is going to allow the bonder to hold, you know, productive assets. You know, this could be, you know, urine positions. It could be, you know, tokens. They could have a basket of assets in Aave and only, you know, borrow as they need to collateralize these transfers. And this is ultimately going to remove all capital inefficiencies around. You know, the bonder role, that they'll basically be able to hold the same basket of assets that they would otherwise, and just earn a some extra yield by performing this active service with their basket of collateral. So that's kind of how we think of capital efficiency with hop today and hop in the future.
Right. It's important to separate these liquidity providers, because the AMM liquidity providers, which we're accustomed to as users, it's just that you're providing liquidity. And in the case of hop, that would be one side would be the canonical a token, and the other side would be the hub version of the token, so that it can be swapped one another at destination or the origin. So from here, actually, I want to dig into, like, we mentioned that bonders, they lock up collateral, and so what is the, let's play the worst case here. So a bonder, he just mints a bunch of H tokens and sends them to himself fraudulently. Such mm-hmm. a transaction doesn't exist. And how do we protect it from this?
Yeah, so when the bonder mints a bunch of H tokens in the current model, since we haven't decoupled the collateral from the asset that's being bridged, they'll actually have an equal amount of that H token. So say it's DAI. So they mint a bunch of H DAI. They'll have an equal amount of H DAI that is locked up and collateralizing that mint or you know, the completion of that transfer. And so if that was actually a fraudulent transfer, when it's not a fraudulent transfer, their collateral is basically unlocked until they can prove that HDAI was burned at the source chain. And so, you know, that proof will, that's what actually gets propagated through layer one as part of the batch. And so if they kind of bond something fraudulently and there never will be proof that does reach the destination, then their HDAI collateral will be permanently locked up, and the bonder just ends up in a complete wash because they basically, you know, locked up HDAI, they've minted an equal amount of HDAI, and now that locked up HDAI is permanently locked. So they ended up exactly where they would be, and the system stays fully collateralized.
And that's great to know, actually. So in terms of like trust assumptions, this is pretty much as close as you can get to Ethereum layer one trust assumptions, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So when Hop protocol, it integrates with many rollups, and each rollups don't necessarily, like, based on the implementation of the specific rollup, it can differ in terms of security, right? And also there's side chains that Hop protocol also support. So in terms of the risk here, am I exposed to the weakest link here of the scaling solutions?
That's a really good question. And so the answer is no, from a user perspective. The bonders tend to be more at risk just because they touch more of the networks. But as a user, you're only exposed to the risk of the networks that you're using and Ethereum. And so what that means is, you know, say you're on XDAI and you're bridging to Polygon, then you know, you're subject to the risk of XDAI, you're subject to the risk of Polygon and Ethereum, but not the risk of Optimism or Arbitrum. Mm-hmm. And so the way that we do this is we kind of track the H tokens that you know, so user deposits, say, DAI into the layer one hop contract, and then they're minted H tokens on the layer two. And so we track how many H tokens are minted for each layer two, and make sure that the H tokens that are kind of exiting that layer two can't exceed the amount that went in. And so that kind of silos or limits the liability any single scaling solution presents to the rest of the system. Because say if a scaling solution were to go rogue and say, you know, try to exit way more liquidity than actually existed on that scaling solution, then this kind of mechanism would just kind of stop it, you know, at the point where they can only kind of compromise the H tokens that are on that scaling solution. And then the bonder role, you know, they are kind of facilitating transfers across these different scaling solutions. Bonders can choose to only support just a subset of scaling solutions, and they can limit their liability that way. But ultimately, you know, they're going to be touching more scaling solutions. And if they bond a transfer from a scaling solution that's gone rogue, there's a chance that scaling solution doesn't propagate the proof over to the destination, and they don't get to kind of unlock their collateral. So that's how you can kind of think about the liability that you'll face when using Hop. And so another point, important note, is that users don't end up with this, you know, wrapped Hop token. They end up with the Canonical token. So what, you know, you'll see with something like, you know, or what we saw with, like, for example, Poly Network is users were bridging assets to another chain. I forget what the chain was, but these were kind of wrapped tokens. What was it?
I said, no one knows.
Yeah. And so users had this wrapped token that was produced by Poly Network. And this is dangerous because users were kind of using these wrapped tokens on that network and not realizing they still had exposure, you know, risk exposure to the bridge. And ultimately, a lot of those users lost their funds without ever kind of when they didn't realize that. With Hop, you're going from one canonical asset to the next. You're only very briefly exposed to this intermediary asset, which means that you only have risk exposure when you're making the transfer from point A to point B. And then the second you have funds on point B, you no longer have risk exposure. So if you're a user, the chances of you losing funds through Hop are very, very low because you only have like a very, very short window of risk exposure.
Yeah, this is like a great property to have for a cross-chain, cross-domain, any cross-domain messaging protocol. So just to break down here and sum up, users only get to have exposure during the time of swap, and bonders only get exposure in the scaling solution for which they provide liquidity. So that's great, actually. So moving on from here, I want to also have your, maybe drifting a bit from Hop protocol, but talking about rollups specifically. I wonder your take about the rollups. How do you see the space to evolve? Like many Giga brains are obviously working to onboard people into scaling solutions, rollups. But do you see any potential resistance from users to onboard to those scaling solutions? If any, what could be a concern there?
That's a good question. So I'm you know, very excited about optimistic rollups. I think that's kind of the, you know, one of the better trade-offs in terms of security and costs that we have right now. But the, you know, ultimately the cost of optimistic rollups is still pretty high. You know, we see kind of like it's like roughly 10% of what we see on mainnet Ethereum, and even 10% of what we see on mainnet Ethereum can still be pretty ridiculous. So, you know, I'm still, you know, bullish on chains like Polygon and XDAI where they don't necessarily, share the same security level of Ethereum, but they do kind of allow these kind of use cases that even optimistic rollups today are pricing out. And so these could be like, you know, very small time users or traders. This could be people that are playing games where just like if they're playing with $10 of value, it doesn't make sense for them to be paying $1 or $2 per transaction, which is kind of what optimistic rollups look like. That being said, if the user's using DeFi, they have, you know, a large part of their, you know, net worth or even, you know, a portion of their net worth on a scaling solution, it probably makes sense for those, you know, for that to be, you know, Optimism or Arbitrum, where we know that the security is kind of matched by at the same level of Ethereum. And so, I think that there's going to be room for both. There's going to be use cases that kind of shake out for both. And then in the long term, I think ZK rollups are really, really interesting. We've kind of seen, you know, I think like looking back in kind of the history of scaling solutions, we've seen how important it is to be EVM compatible. So like we saw like Plasma, people are trying to build application specific Plasma implementations. We saw state channels and generalized state channels and like games to start playing out there. But you know, the second we kind of saw EVM compatible scaling solutions where we could just use the same tools, the same development tools that, you know, we could just point block explorers at them and they just work. That's where we've kind of really seen this explosion of activity on scaling solutions, as well as kind of non-Ethereum EVM chains. And so like, I really think that that's where ZK rollups need to ultimately get. But it's a really, really difficult challenge. You know, there's people that much smarter than I am that are working on this challenge. So, you know, excited to kind of see where those kind of develop, because I think ultimately that is kind of the holy grail, is that EVM compatible ZK rollup where the exits are instant. The level of scalability is higher than what we can achieve with optimistic rollups. And yeah, that's kind of the ultimate scaling solution, I think.
Yeah, thank you for sharing your thoughts. And in that world where, in that imaginary world where ZK proofs are so efficient and then we checkpoint every, like, frequently, then would Hop evolve into something different? Because now, like, providing, like, fast, let's say, fast exits is kind of loses its benefit, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I don't think Hop would kind of evolve into something different, because we see fast exits as like our big market today. But ultimately, we see the real value of Hop is kind of enabling these layer two native users where they can just move directly from one layer two to the next, and they don't have to kind of touch layer one at all. And so while yes, Hop does kind of solve this fast exit problem, and that's very, very needed today, that is kind of like one of the main benefits of Hop today. Even in a world where there is no long exit times and you could exit a ZK rollup immediately, exiting a ZK rollup to move to the next rollup is still going to cost $100 today or hundreds of dollars today, could cost thousands of dollars in the future. And so we still see huge benefit for users to be able to move directly from one ZK rollup to the next using something like Hop.
I see. And also there's the area of like just cross-chain messaging, right? It's not only a value transfer. Ultimately, they have to talk to each other ideally. But I also wonder your take there. So when one rollups communicates to another, if there is no bonder to front liquidity immediately as it is right now, then the communication would still be delayed with the L1 finality, right? So in Ethereum, you need to wait so many blocks, depending on the amount, let's say, involved. But so it's not like we have this full composability that Ethereum L1 has today. Do you think that could be a potential problem? How could that be mitigated? Wonder your thoughts.
Yeah, it will definitely be a challenge. So kind of in terms of cross-chain messaging and composability, we kind of see this move from a synchronous paradigm where each contract can just kind of talk to other contracts. Each transaction is completely atomic, where if the transaction reverts anywhere along the way, the entire thing is unwound. And then we're moving towards this like asynchronous paradigm where now we have the transaction starts and then there's like different times where we wait and then the transaction is completed at a later time, and you also lose that atomicity of the transaction where say the transaction reverts at during the second part. You can't necessarily unwind the first part because they're kind of happening at different times, and so this kind of presents a challenge. I wouldn't say that it's necessarily a very bad thing, but you have to kind of deal with the problems that come with this asynchronous communication, and so the way we kind of think about the trust model on layer one Ethereum today is you have this this message from one contract to the next. It happens immediately, and then it's also like an owned message where you can actually see who sent it and verify that in absolute terms. And so with cross-chain communication, it kind of breaks up into two trust models, and so. One of them is where you can communicate from one contract on one rollup to the next rollup immediately, but that's not like an own message. You can't actually verify who sent it. It's more or less just, you know, triggering a meta transaction at the destination. But this can still be very useful, especially if you can attach tokens to that message. So for example, someone could, you know, send USDC through Hop to the destination and trigger some functionality that deposits it into, you know, a vault contract with, you know, a specific owner address. And, you know, that we don't need to verify who sent the funds. We just need to verify that funds showed up. And so, you know, we don't, you know, that type of communication is fine. It can happen pretty much immediately. And then there's this kind of second type of communication where we actually need to verify the sender.
To clarify, that is the case where the transaction involves some token transfers, right? It has the token, so you don't bother with any further information. Is that why so?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And for most use cases for this type of communication, there would need to be some token attached, unless you just want to kind of, you know, kick off some process or something. You know, there's easier ways to do that than cross-chain, you know, cross-chain call, you know, unless there's tokens attached. Mm-hmm. And so this other type of communication is that's where things are really delayed. And so this is where we actually need to verify who sent the transaction at the you know, at the source. And so for that to kind of fully verify who sent it, we actually need to wait for the exit time of the source roll up. And then that, you know, and then once it reaches the destination, then we can know in absolute terms that, you know, it was sent from, you know, this address with on, you know, this roll up. And then, you know, that could be used for something like withdrawing from a vault that is owned by a cross chain owner. Mm-hmm. or, you know, on a different scaling solution. So yeah, that's kind of what we think about the two different models. And so Vitalik actually released a really interesting paper on doing cross-chain NFTs and he has a very interesting twist on this second model where Hop has kind of a similar twist for ERC-20 transfers where basically you complete it immediately, it can be verified off-chain. And then it isn't until it can be verified on chain that you can, like, you know, completely
release the collateral,
like settle. Yeah, exactly. So with his proposal, you basically can transfer an NFT from one source chain, mint a kind of claim to that NFT at the destination. Everyone can verify that off chain. And then it's not until it's verified on chain that it's kind of like completely settled up. So it kind of shows how you can get around the constraints of this this asynchronous communication and these long exit times without significantly damaging the user experience.
Okay, that's very, very interesting because like almost all in almost all cases NFTs cannot be ported over bridges due to their uniqueness. I mean, this talk was like super insightful in my opinion. And when you think about it, like if a bunch of rollups exist, eventually there will be a cross rollup communication across the sidechain as well communication in the Ethereum world. But moving on from Ethereum world, what's your take on L1 versus L2s? There we see a bunch of L1 projects also running EVM chains like Avalanche, for instance, and others as well. I mean, Solana is doing great stuff as well. So yeah, how do you see this competition to move on? And can Hop eventually support other chains as well?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so, yeah, I think it's undeniable that we're headed to this multi-chain world. You know, like we're both seeing Ethereum kind of scale on its own layer two, and then we're also seeing, you know, like competing layer ones popped up, like you mentioned, and those kind of also provide, or they also are like cheaper environments because they either, you know, make different trade-offs or you know, they're also just, you know, less congested than what Ethereum is today, and that kind of, you know, unlocks use cases that just aren't possible on Ethereum today, or allows, you know, smaller users to interact, and so. Yeah, I think it's undeniable that that's where things are headed. We're seeing, you know, chains like Solana get serious traction. And so, you know, we definitely want to support bridging across, you know, not just Ethereum's scaling ecosystem, but also to these disjointed layer ones eventually. And there's a few ways we could do it. So you know, like we talked about, you know, Hop very much relies on the cross-domain messaging between Ethereum and whatever scaling solution we're supporting. Some of these, and so when we think about risk of a user on a scaling solution, they're subject to the risk of that scaling solution, and then also its bridge. And so with rollups, those are one and the same. And then also with you know, chains like Polygon, they're you know, pretty much one and the same as well. But some of these kind of more disjointed layer ones have introduced messaging bridges with Ethereum, and you know, those might have different trust models that they introduce, and so we could we could support these disjointed layer ones, and they would basically be subject to whatever the trust model of the messaging bridge is, as well as, you know, the security of that chain itself. Right. So this is one option that we see, and that option is really available in the near term. And then another option that's available or that we will likely head towards in the future is, you know, for chains that don't even have a messaging bridge with Ethereum today, we could actually create one and you know, possibly, you know, create our own messaging bridge and our own. It, you know, this would likely involve introducing a new validator set that approves these messages, and that would, you know, kind of allow us to bridge to completely disjointed layer ones.
Yeah, got it. The bridges is quite complex, and so it's a very open design space, and it seems like we're using them more now. And it's going to keep increasing. So yeah. So I think this was a great conversation, and we've covered I think almost all important properties of Hop protocol. And I'm super excited about Hop. Before we close out, I have to ask this question, and it'll be a short one. When token?
Yeah, I can't say much, but you know, we would like to kind of further decentralize the protocol, and so we are kind of exploring ways that we can do that.
Okay, so the details around the token is I assume are not let's say publicly disclosed at this point. Is that correct?
Yeah, we're still kind of figuring out which direction we'll take.
Got it. Okay, Chris. Thank you very much for joining. It was a great pleasure.
Thanks for having me on, Ken. It was a great conversation. And yeah, I really appreciate it.
Before we go, we'd like to thank our sponsors for making this episode possible. With a proven track record of delivering products safely, the Kava platform is DeFi's most trusted, scalable, and secure institutional-grade cross-chain engine. In addition to the protocols Kava and Hard, the Kava platform is launching Swap Protocol, a cross-chain AMM liquidity hub bridging DeFi, blockchains, and financial services to swap the world's largest assets and maximize yields across your entire portfolio. Try for yourself or learn more today by visiting kava.io. Celo is an open platform for mobile-first DeFi with a vision of bringing decentralized financial tools and services to anyone with a mobile phone. Eco-friendly, Ethereum-compatible, and governed by Celo holders, Celo's proof-of-stake consensus mechanism and automatic daily carbon offsets make Celo the world's first carbon-negative blockchain, offsetting over 2,200 tons of carbon to date. To learn more about how to lend, earn, and stake with Celo's growing family of platform-native stablecoins, visit Celo.org today.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed it, please support the show by hitting subscribe on iTunes, writing a review, or sharing this episode on Twitter and LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our next episode out soon.